Side 7, Man and His Symbols, by Carl G. Jung. Continuing with The Process of Individuation, on page 220. Our dream life allows us to have a look at these subliminal perceptions and shows us that they have an effect upon us. After having an agreeable dream about somebody, even without interpreting the dream, I shall involuntarily look at that person with more interest. The dream image may have deluded me because of my projections, or it may have given me objective information. To find out which is the correct interpretation requires an honest, attentive attitude and careful thought. But, as is the case with all inner processes, it is ultimately the self that orders and regulates one's human relationships. So long as the conscious ego takes the trouble to detect the delusive projections and deals with these inside himself instead of outside. It is in this way that spiritually attuned and similarly oriented people find their way to one another to create a group that cuts across all the usual social and organizational affiliations of people. Such a group is not in conflict with others. It is merely different and independent. The consciously realized process of individuation thus changes a person's relationships. The familiar bonds, such as kinship or common interests, are replaced by a different type of unity, a bond through the self. All activities and obligations that belong exclusively to the outer world do definite harm to the secret activities of the unconscious. Through these unconscious ties, those who belong together come together. That is one reason why attempts to influence people by advertisements and political propaganda are destructive, even when inspired by idealistic motives. This raises the important question of whether the unconscious part of the human psyche can be influenced at all. Practical experience and accurate observations show that one cannot influence one's own dreams. There are people, it is true, who assert that they can influence them, but if you look into their dream material, you find that they do only what I do with my disobedient dog. I order him to do those things I notice he wants to do anyhow, so that I can preserve my illusion of authority. Only a long process of interpreting one's dreams and confronting oneself with what they have to say can gradually transform the unconscious. And conscious attitudes also must change in this process. If a man who wants to influence public opinion misuses symbols for this purpose, they will naturally impress the masses insofar as they are true symbols. But whether or not the mass unconscious will be emotionally gripped by them is something that cannot be calculated in advance, something that remains completely irrational. No music publisher, for instance, can tell in advance whether a song will become a hit or not, even though it may draw on popular images and melodies. No deliberate attempts to influence the unconscious have yet produced any significant results, and it seems that the mass unconscious preserves its autonomy just as much as the individual unconscious. At times, in order to express its purposes, the unconscious may use a motif from our external world and thus may seem to have been influenced by it. For instance, I have come across many dreams of modern people that have to do with Berlin. In these dreams, Berlin stands as a symbol of the psychic weak spot, the place of danger, and for this reason is the place where the self is apt to appear. It is the point where the dreamer is torn by conflict and where he might therefore be able to unite the inner opposites. I have also encountered an extraordinary number of dream reactions to the film Hiroshima Mon Amour. In most of these dreams, the idea was expressed that either the two lovers in the film must unite, which symbolizes the union of inner opposites, or there would be an atomic explosion, a symbol of complete dissociation, equivalent to madness. Only when the manipulators of public opinion add commercial pressure or acts of violence to their activities do they seem to achieve a temporary success, but in fact this merely causes a repression of the genuine unconscious reactions. And mass repression leads to the same result as individual repression, that is, to neurotic dissociation and psychological illness. All such attempts to repress the reactions of the unconscious must fail in the long run, for they are basically opposed to our instincts. We know from studying the social behavior of the higher animals that small groups, from approximately 10 to 50 individuals, create the best possible living conditions for the single animal as well as for the group. And man seems to be no exception in this respect. His physical well-being, his spiritual psychic health, and beyond the animal realm, his cultural efficiency seem to flourish best in such a social function. As far as we at present understand the process of individuation, the self apparently tends to produce such small groups by creating at the same time sharply defined ties of feeling between certain individuals and feelings of relatedness to all people. Only if these connections are created by the self can one feel any assurance that envy, jealousy, fighting, and all manner of negative projections will not break up the group. Thus, an unconditional devotion to one's own process of individuation also brings about the best possible adaptation. This does not mean, of course, that there will not be collisions of opinion and conflicting obligations, or disagreement about the right way, in face of which one must constantly withdraw and listen to one's inner voice in order to find the individual standpoint that the self intends one to have. Fanatical political activity, but not the performance of essential duties, seems somehow incompatible with individuation. A man who devoted himself entirely to freeing his country from foreign occupation had this dream. With some of my compatriots, I go up a stairway to the attic of a museum where there is a hall painted black and looking like a cabin on a ship. A distinguished-looking middle-aged lady opens the door. Her name is X, daughter of X. X was a famous national hero of the dreamer's country who attempted some centuries ago to free it. He might be compared to Joan of Arc or William Tell. In reality, X had no children. In the hall, we see the portraits of two aristocratic ladies dressed in flowery brocaded garments. While Miss X is explaining these pictures to us, they suddenly come to life. First, the eyes begin to live, and then the chest seems to breathe. People are surprised and go to a lecture room where Miss X will speak to them about the phenomenon. She says that through her intuition and feeling, these portraits came alive. But some of the people are indignant and say that Miss X is mad. Some even leave the lecture room. The important feature of this dream is that the anima figure, Miss X, is purely a creation of the dream. She has, however, the name of a famous national hero liberator, as if she were, for instance, Wilhelmina Tell, the daughter of William Tell. By the implications contained in the name, the unconscious is pointing to the fact that today the dreamer should not try, as X did long ago, to free his country in an outer way. Now, the dream says, liberation is accomplished by the anima, by the dreamer's soul, who accomplishes it by bringing the images of the unconscious to life. That the hall in the attic of the museum looks partly like a ship's cabin painted black is very meaningful. The black color hints at darkness, night, a turning inward, and if the hall is a cabin, then the museum is somehow also a ship. This suggests that when the mainland of collective consciousness becomes flooded by unconsciousness and barbarism, this museum ship, filled with living images, may turn into a saving ark that will carry those who enter it to another spiritual shore. Portraits hanging in a museum are usually the dead remains of the past, and often the images of the unconscious are regarded in the same way until we discover that they are alive and meaningful. When the anima, who appears here in her rightful role of soul guide, contemplates the images with intuition and feeling, they begin to live. The indignant people in the dream represent the side of the dreamer that is influenced by collective opinion, something in him that distrusts and rejects the bringing to life of psychic images. They personify a resistance to the unconscious that might express itself something like this. But what if they begin dropping atom bombs on us? Psychological insight won't be much help then. This resistant side is unable to free itself from statistical thinking and from extroverted rational prejudices. The dream, however, points out that in our time, genuine liberation can start only with a psychological transformation. To what end does one liberate one's country if afterward there is no meaningful goal of life, no goal for which it is worthwhile to be free? If man no longer finds any meaning in his life, it makes no difference whether he wastes away under a communist or a capitalist regime. Only if he can use his freedom to create something meaningful is it relevant that he should be free? That is why finding the inner meaning of life is more important to the individual than anything else, and why the process of individuation must be given priority. Attempts to influence public opinion by means of newspapers, radio, television, and advertising are based on two factors. On the one hand, they rely on sampling techniques that reveal the trend of opinion or wants, that is, of collective attitudes. On the other, they express prejudices, projections, and unconscious complexes, mainly the power complex of those who manipulate public opinion. But statistics do no justice to the individual. Although the average size of stones in a heap may be 5 centimeters, one will find very few stones of exactly this size in the heap. That the second factor cannot create anything positive is clear from the start. But if a single individual devotes himself to individuation, he frequently has a positive, contagious effect on the people around him. It is as if a spark leaps from one to another, and this usually occurs when one has no intention of influencing others, and often when one uses no words. It is onto this inner path that Miss X tried to lead the dreamer. Nearly all religious systems on our planet contain images that symbolize the process of individuation, or at least some stages of it. In Christian countries, the self is projected, as I said before, onto the second Adam, Christ. In the East, the relevant figures are those of Krishna and Buddha. For people who are contained in a religion, that is, who still really believe in its content and teachings, the psychological regulation of their lives is affected by religious symbols, and even their dreams often revolve around them. When the late Pope Pius XII issued the Declaration of the Assumption of Mary, a Catholic woman dreamed, for instance, that she was a Catholic priestess. Her unconscious seemed to extend the dogma in this way: if Mary is now almost a goddess, she should have priestesses. Another Catholic woman, who had resistances to some of the minor and outer aspects of her creed, dreamed that the church of her home city had been pulled down and rebuilt, but that the tabernacle, with the consecrated host and the statue of the Virgin Mary, were to be transferred from the old to the new church. The dream showed her that some of the man-made aspects of her religion needed renewal, but that its basic symbols, gods having become man and the Great Mother, the Virgin Mary, would survive the change. Such dreams demonstrate the living interest that the unconscious takes in the conscious religious representations of an individual. This raises the question whether it is possible to detect a general trend in all the religious dreams of contemporary people. In the manifestations of the unconscious found in our modern Christian culture, whether Protestant or Catholic, Dr. Jung often observed that there is an unconscious tendency at work to round off our Trinitarian formula of the Godhead with a fourth element, which tends to be feminine, dark, and even evil. Actually, this fourth element has always existed in the realm of our religious representations, but it was separated from the image of God and became his counterpart in the form of matter itself, or the Lord of Matter, that is, the devil. Now, the unconscious seems to want to reunite these extremes, the light having become too bright and the darkness too somber. Naturally, it is the central symbol of religion, the image of the Godhead, that is most exposed to unconscious tendencies toward transformation. A Tibetan abbot once told Dr. Jung that the most impressive mandalas in Tibet are built up by imagination or directed fantasy, when the psychological balance of the group is disturbed or when a particular thought cannot be rendered because it is not yet contained in the sacred doctrine and must therefore be searched for. In these remarks, two equally important basic aspects of mandala symbolism emerge. The mandala serves a conservative purpose, namely to restore a previously existing order. But it also serves the creative purpose of giving expression and form to something that does not yet exist, something new and unique. The second aspect is perhaps even more important than the first, but does not contradict it. For in most cases, what restores the old order simultaneously involves some element of new creation. In the new order, the older pattern returns on a higher level. The process is that of the ascending spiral, which grows upward while simultaneously returning again and again to the same point. A painting by a simple woman who was brought up in Protestant surroundings shows a mandala in the form of a spiral. In a dream, this woman received an order to paint the Godhead. Later, also in a dream, she saw it in a book. Of God himself, she saw only his wafting cloak, the drapery of which made a beautiful display of light and shadow. This contrasted impressively with the stability of the spiral in the deep blue sky. Fascinated by the cloak and the spiral, the dreamer did not look closely at the other figure on the rocks. When she awoke and thought about who these divine figures were, she suddenly realized that it was God himself. This gave her a frightful shock, which she felt for a long time. Usually, the Holy Ghost is represented in Christian art by a fiery wheel or a dove, but here it has appeared as a spiral. This is a new thought, not yet contained in the doctrine, which has spontaneously arisen from the unconscious. That the Holy Ghost is the power that works for the further development of our religious understanding is not a new idea, of course, but its symbolic representation in the form of a spiral is new. The same woman then painted a second picture, also inspired by a dream, showing the dreamer with her positive animus standing above Jerusalem when the wing of Satan descends to darken the city. The satanic wing strongly reminded her of the wafting cloak of God in the first painting, but in the former dream, the spectator is high up, somewhere in heaven, and sees in front of her a terrific split between the rocks. The movement in the cloak of God is an attempt to reach Christ, the figure on the right, but it does not quite succeed. In the second painting, the same thing is seen from below, from a human angle. Looking at it from a higher angle, what is moving and spreading is a part of God. Above that rises the spiral as a symbol of possible further development. But seen from the basis of our human reality, this same thing in the air is the dark, uncanny wing of the devil. In the dreamer's life, these two pictures became real in a way that does not concern us here, but it is obvious that they also contain a collective meaning that reaches beyond the personal. They may prophesy the descent of a divine darkness upon the Christian hemisphere, a darkness that points, however, toward the possibility of further evolution. Since the axis of the spiral does not move upward, but into the background of the picture, the further evolution will lead neither to greater spiritual height nor down into the realm of matter, but to another dimension, probably into the background of these divine figures, and that means into the unconscious. When religious symbols that are partly different from those we know emerge from the unconscious of an individual, it is often feared that these will wrongfully alter or diminish the officially recognized religious symbols. This fear even causes many people to reject political psychology and the entire unconscious. If I look at such a resistance from a psychological point of view,